This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Bourne.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, of course, this means war. Narrative conflict in speculative fiction.
Now, this episode is a bit spontaneous, and it comes in response to the fact that Jules is angry today.
I'm not angry, I'm just in a pissy mood. There's a distinction. Anger is usually somewhat logical.
I message Jules, I say, how are you today? And she just says, I'm pissed off.
Everybody else who's stupid. Basically, in humid weather, I should not go anywhere or talk to anyone or, you know, interact with anybody, basically, is what it comes down to.
I did say, is it because of the heat? No.
The thing is, it's not just because of the heat, because this is actually perfectly tolerable as long as I'm not outside.
Hmm.
So this is fine for me at the moment, or, you know, it's at least it's copable as long as I'm not, like, putting up shelves or something.
Yes.
But, yes, my area of enclosed, what is personal space, sort of expands to 10 feet in every direction around me at certain points. And, I can't explain it in a way that will make sense to anybody else. I think you kind of have to live in my head, and I don't actually wish that on anyone. So let's just say that it got me thinking of other types of conflict, and we haven't actually really done an episode on narrative conflict, and that is an extremely important staple of the writer's diet.
It is. So when we talk about conflict, we don't necessarily mean physical conflict. So it doesn't... Conflict is basically a problem which needs to be solved. And conflict is, as Jules has said, the staple of most stories. In fact, I would say you cannot have a gripping or interesting story, whether it's short or long, without a form of conflict.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. And it's the idea that conflict is the juxtaposition in a uncomfortable or stimulating way between where the main character is at and mm-hmm. certain other influences. And this actually encompasses a huge, huge, great long list, which we'll get into in a minute. Mm-hmm. But yeah, story with no conflict equals boring story. And I have seen some more literary experimental fiction whereby there genuinely is no conflict. And okay, they might be great pieces of literature, and I can't tell you any off the top of my head. But honestly, the whole idea that there being no conflict in there means that I have kind of erased them as I've read them.
Yeah.
It's very different from having, say, very subtle conflict. For example, if we look at Catherine Mansfield's story, Bliss, which mm-hmm. Focuses on a beautiful garden and a woman out there talking to one of her friends. And on the surface, there is absolutely no conflict, except the entire story is about suddenly realizing that you have sexual desire for somebody of the same sex, but not being able to act upon it. So going back and acting upon it with your husband instead, which, you know, is boiling that really well-written and very clever story down to its constituents, and there's a lot more to it than that. But obviously there is conflict there. So we'll get into what different types of conflict there are in a minute. But other things that we've said that conflict obviously drives the plot. In that example I just mentioned, you can explore character arc with conflict.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Which is important, because at the end of a story, a character should not be quite the same person they were at the beginning. And you need conflict in order to, you know, diamonds don't polish themselves. You need, don't form themselves. Like, you need a lot of pressure in order to make them what they are.
And this is something that we've touched on in previous episodes, but in regards to story structure in general, I'd say that you have these two main ones. You have the tragic plot, what I call the tragic plot, and then you have the A to B. And A to B is internal as well as external. Sorry, this is just a reminder. This is just the basics. And yeah, in order to get to a different place, there needs to have been a change. There needs to have been a journey. For there to have been a journey, there needs to have been something to overcome. So conflict is necessary. Unless you are writing about a character who never ever changes for whatever reason, in which case you might use conflict in a different way.
Yeah, absolutely. And another thing that conflict can be used for is to throw a curveball, or you get to a point in a story where, if you're writing it, perhaps you don't know where you're going, or you think this is going to start losing the reader's attention, so you light a fire, so to speak. Mm. Not literally, don't go out and really light a fire.
Burn it to the ground!
Basically, a good rule for writing, and I say rule in inverted commas because I don't think there are really rules and you shouldn't follow anything slavishly, but a mm-hmm. good rule for writing is that if you have a character in a situation, you should always try to do the worst possible thing to them you can.
Yeah.
As I said, don't take that with a pinch of salt, as same with any other writing rules, but that usually gives you a good starting point for where you really want to get to. With yeah. a character arc or with a plot.
Yeah.
Don't absolutely. Pull your punches.
Yeah. and to be honest, I think that most people don't really like to pull their punches. People complain, it's like, oh, yeah, they're my precious character, I want to take care of them. But actually, most writers do reflect for their characters and do want them to suffer. It's just the way we are. So.
I think Madeline's talking very much from her perspective here with, I love him. I want to hurt him.
Oh, like,
I want to do bad things to him.
I want to do bad things to him. I should mention that is only in fiction. I'm not like that in real life for real people. I don't meet people and just go, God, you know, like, I'm not with Jules. I'm not like, Jules, I love you. You're my best friend. I desperately want you to be hurt by something. That is not a thing that happens. It's only in fiction. You do not wish conflict on people in real life, just in fiction. In fiction because it makes it interesting, and because it is meant to be cathartic. So there
yes.
you go.
I mean, as a complete sidebar, a good metric of when I've really got a character right is Madeline says, I really love this character. And then a little bit later, like, you know, I really want to hurt them, right? So whenever I've gone on a really sadistic route with a character, you can probably thank Madeline for a lot of that.
You're welcome, guys.
That's certainly something.
No, but seriously, you've indulged me way too much.
Well, I could stop. I mean, it's something that's probably going to happen. I say probably. Something that's happening with this second book that I'm writing at the moment.
Yes. Well, I know there's something that's right there because literally I begged you for it and you went, yeah, I guess that could work. So I am forever, forever in your debt for allowing this to happen. Anyway.
So, yeah, I mean, the idea of the idea of narrative conflict is a delicate balancing act. You don't want a reader to be so stressed that they put the book down.
No.
Or you don't want them to be so stressed that they kind of go past it, you know, that you've wrought them to a fever pitch of tension and then you just keep stringing it out to the point where, quite honestly, nobody can feel terrified or upset or anxious over a character all the time. So you need to know when to play that final note on that particular thread of conflict.
Yeah. And as I said, meant to be cathartic as well. So conflict, I mean, doesn't necessarily tie in with hurting characters or causing tragedy and things like that, but they often are related. And the nicest part of conflict is the resolution and how it is resolved. Now, sometimes you might resolve it in a poor way, which is meant to be interesting. When I say a poor way, I mean a poor way for your characters and not your writing. But so it might not actually be resolved. It might But for the most part, for main characters, they overcome conflict, and that might be something a little bit bittersweet, but at the end, that resolution does come through. And you don't really want to be stringing, as Jules has said, you don't really want to be stringing readers through conflict after conflict after conflict with no resolution. Because at that point, it gets, first of all, confusing and kind of irritating, and then quite boring.
Yeah, there absolutely has to be a climax. And now I've said that, I'm thinking, the whole sort of idea of stringing things out and then not delivering may be bad and could be taken as I'm talking about something completely different. No, your character definitely needs a certain number of wins. And they shouldn't be too many wins either. I mean, if you give them wins all the time, then you've lost all that tension, all that narrative tension from the conflict in the first place. So you want a nice balance, probably about sort of 2/3 conflict or 1/3 sort of almost winning with the occasional big win thrown in.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not an exact recipe. It depends what you're writing. Obviously, if you're writing suspense or mystery, then you probably want a lot more conflict.
Yes.
Or, you know, thrillers as well. Horror, you want a lot of conflict.
You do need quite a lot of conflict. Political dramas, I mean, dramas are based entirely on conflict. So, yeah. But there's, as we said, there are different levels of conflict. So shall we explore some of those different levels of conflict?
Yeah, definitely. And probably a big one that everyone will think, we say conflict, people think it's external conflict. It's conflict that's coming from an outside agent. So it could be an argument with another character. It could be a massive war that's happening. It could be, as you said, like a big political intrigue. It could be a huge, you know, uber enemy of some kind. So anything that's external to the main character is the external conflict. I mean, to be honest, this can work on a small scale as well. I mean, if you're looking at sort of a cozy mystery or a sort of cozy romance or something, and your main character is someone who makes the best marmalade ever, and then lo and behold, someone else moves to their little quiet, sleepy Dorset village and they make the best strawberry jam. And suddenly there isn't a marmalade and a strawberry jam category in the Women's Institute competition. There's only a sort of condiment competition. So they're going head to head. There you go. That's conflict, and that's external conflict. It's quite amusing, and it tells you a lot about the characters. But I suppose you could play it so that it was actually really bitter and horrible as well.
You absolutely could, yes. And it's interesting that that's a really good example of conflict, because once again, when we think of external conflict, because of the word, we do think of something which is very competitive. Another example of an external conflict could be something as simple as losing something.
Yeah.
You might see in very young children's books, you will see that they also have conflict because it's something that they have to overcome. So I think there's a little children's picture book called or something like that about this little this teddy bear which gets lost. And that's the conflict. The conflict is the teddy bear has been lost. And they have to sort of find it. And then when they do find it, someone else has got it as a prize and they have to get it back. And there's no competition in terms of it's not one person versus another person. It's a situation which has caused conflict. So that is an external form of conflict, which will then reflect the internal form of conflict.
Yeah, and it's interesting, obviously, that you mentioned children's books and children's picture books, as you say, unless they're like board books that are teaching you how to count or what colour is blue and what is yellow, then if they've got a story, there is conflict there. And a popular one is obviously things like the ones that centre around I don't want a brother, for example. And a young child has found out that they're going to have a sibling very soon, and the conflict is with the adults who are inflicting this new person on them.
How dare they?
How dare they? And they tend to be really, really good books as well. I think that's the real skill with picture books, is getting conflict, meaningful conflict, that resonates with a very young child and keeps their attention. And it is really hard to keep a young child's attention.
It is.
Into such as, I mean, they've got perhaps 6-7 100 words to work with, usually.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a few more, but not many. And maybe quite a few less than that. So it takes real skill. So whenever anybody's sort of like going, "Pfft, that's just a picture book," I'm like, have you any idea how difficult it is to write a meaningful picture book that a child will love?
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's difficult. Anyway, there's also internal conflict. And normally this means that a character is struggling either to reconcile two juxtaposed ideas or positions within themselves, or struggling mm-hmm. to reconcile part of themselves with something that's external. But the conflict is coming from the character. Nobody else really knows it's there. So I suppose a good example of this would be in young adult fiction, where you have a sort of coming out story where someone's trying to reconcile the fact that they are gay or bi or trans or whatever, and trying to resolve it within themselves when perhaps the outside world isn't quite as welcoming, or at least they assume the outside world isn't as welcoming.
Yeah, absolutely. And identity is also a big part of that. You can have a lot of conflict which comes in with identity, not just in terms of sexuality, but in terms of what am I without such and such.
Yeah.
For instance, this is going to sound like a very random example, and I can't even remember the name, but you know those horsey books that you read, that some girls read when they're young? I was really into that all that whole thing, and there was this great little book I used to read about, you know, this girl, she was a premium rider, very, very good, and she had a really, really bad accident that caused her a lot of damage, and at that point she was obviously very, very scared. It's a very familiar story. She was very scared of getting back to riding again. She was very scared of getting back to competitive sort of jumping. And so the whole way, she then, there's this massive internal crisis whereby that was a large part of her identity, and suddenly she's lost it, and she's lost her confidence. And so it wasn't in terms of, oh, who I am is not accepted. It's, I don't know who I am. And she sort of had to rediscover herself, and she had to rediscover her courage and re-examine how she was going to look at things. And it was a children's book. But you do sometimes, you do get those kinds of conflicts in children's books, and particularly in YA, where something has been lost or something has been removed, or a certainty has become uncertain. And suddenly there's this massive internal question of, well, what does that mean for me?
Yeah, a good example of that is Eliza and Her Monsters by Francesca Zappia. It tells mm-hmm. the story of a girl who is in her senior year at school, but she's not actually too worried about her exams or her college or anything like that, because ultimately she doesn't have to worry about getting a scholarship. For the last 3 years, she's been the mastermind behind an online webcomic, but apart from four other online friends, nobody knows her identity. Nobody really knows who she is. So she's safe, and this is bringing in huge amounts of money, which she's keeping in the bank account, which is pretty much, you know, secret. Her parents are very involved in their own thing, and they kind of don't really understand her, but she's kind of okay with that, because, you know, she's already basically doing a full-time job and working at school and things as well, and everything's fine, but she's in this insulated little bubble where she doesn't ever have to push outside her boundaries. And then she meets a guy who's new, who's transferred to her school, and he's done fan art of some of her characters, and she recognizes him straight away. But she meets him when a couple of bullies start trying to beat up on him, and she would normally be like a complete physical coward, but because he's done fan art of her stuff, she's kind of like, well, I feel I've got to do something, because it's one of my fans, even though he doesn't know who I am. So she gets involved, and they end up becoming friends, and it turns out that he's trying to write a novelization of this online comic, which she loves, so she's reading it all the way through, and it just gets more and more awkward, because she is this one person online who is part of who she is, but she's also this other person who didn't really socialise with people much before, but now has found out that there is a group of people out there that she does like to see in person. And then she realises she has feelings for the guy, and he has feelings for her, and it gets more and more and more awkward, because she just hasn't told him who she really is. So yeah, it's a massive conflict, and you know, it's woven in with things like anxiety and suddenly discovering that you cannot write, you cannot create anymore because something traumatic's happened to you.
Yeah.
All the conflict is internal in that book, and yet it's an amazingly gripping book. It's written so well, you'd think it was a thriller. It's that much of a page-turner. I suppose things like Pride and Prejudice, again, all the conflict is more or less internal, except for a little bit here and there. And yet,
yeah, absolutely.
It's as page-turning as sort of the spy who came in from the cold. So,
yeah.
Or slightly more so.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's quite interesting because, you know, The Walking Dead?
Yes.
Well, in The Walking Dead Season 2, a lot of people got very annoyed with it because they said, well, you know, it was all cool kind of things and, you know, internal politics and internal, you know, conflict among the group, and you didn't really see much of the zombies. And a lot of people got really frustrated with that, whereas I really enjoyed it because the zombies were this massive external complexity that, you know, conflict, whereby they were literal zombies, okay? They were walkers. They were killing people and eating them.
Yeah.
Forcing this group in position into a very haphazard position where they were trying to live and be normal, but they couldn't. And because they had this massive constraint, there was this brilliant internal conflict where they're half of them are desperately trying to survive and readapt to this new way of life, while the other half are desperately trying to hold on to what they perceive as humanity, and what it is to be human, what it is to be moral, what it is to be right. And of course, they can't hold on to these things because they're no longer practical.
Yeah.
And I found it fascinating to see this group dynamic, with them all struggling with this, and but all at different stages, so they're all fighting about it with different things, and I really, really enjoyed it. I thought it was brilliant, and I thought that was a great way of having that marriage between external and internal conflict, and how the two can be separate and yet entirely related to one another.
Yeah, I completely agree, and it's why some horror films, particularly things like slasher flicks, so things like that tend to be quite hollow. I mean, if you literally you're going along for cheap thrills and a cheap scare, then that's fine if that's what you like, but I find them really unengaging because they're not about the people. What they're about is all these horrible things that are happening with no real context or nothing really to pin you to.
Yeah.
And it's like, I found the, I don't know if you've ever seen it. Have you seen the first Alien versus Predator film?
No. Yes, I have.
Okay, the first two-thirds of that film are a big pile of pants. You know, really, really are. And the last third is really good because suddenly it's about this final girl who manages somehow to earn the respect of a predator. And they can't even communicate with each other verbally, and yet somehow they share this bond through killing the aliens. And I'm not trying to say this is high art, because it really isn't, but after the disappointing first two-thirds of that film, that last third was like, that was what the film should have been about. Why did you subject us to that previous bollocks? So yeah, and I suppose it's kind of like the superhero thing, whereby the important thing with superhumans is the human part, not the super part. It's about the humans, not the powers. And then the same with horror, it's not about the horrific things that are happening. And with ghost stories, it's not actually about the ghosts, it's about the living. It's always about the people, and it's about their internal issues. That's why The Haunting of Hill House, the new series on Netflix, worked so well, because it was about this interfamilial dynamic. And yeah, there was some creepy ghosts and shit going on there, I'm not gonna lie, but the important part was the family and how they the tragic things that happened to them.
Yeah, and I think a very common thing is that the main character will often not be able to resolve the external conflict until they have resolved their internal conflict. It's part of the change, and again, this is something I've discussed before, when we move from different motivations, the different things that drive us, and part of that change between the second motivation to the third, the righteous motivation, comes from resolving that internal conflict which is blocking them from doing what they need to do. An example of this is the new Shazam movie.
Yeah.
Which recently, it's great, it's very funny. whereby, and not to give too many spoilers, you know, but Billy has been looking for his mother for the entirety of the film. And it has been a massive issue in terms of not just his identity, but what family means. And it's something that distracts him, and it means that he's always kind of isolated himself because he only ever wanted to be with her. Forces him to re-examine that. And it's only when he re-examines that he actually figures out really what he needs to do in order to defeat the greater evil that has been beating him every single time up until this point.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. It's that classic Karate Kid thing of, I will never have peace or honour with in myself unless I can continue this last fight, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a sort of accepting of responsibilities and acknowledging your place within the world and what you can do about it. So, yeah. Shazam's a really great example. I would also add, there's two other types of conflict I would talk about, and I suppose you could consider at least this next one to be external, but it's a lot more personalised, so I thought it deserved a separate category. Mm-hmm. And that's the inter-character conflict. So between enemies, between friends, between lovers, and they're all slightly different conflicts usually.
Yeah.
So if we say between enemies, when we say enemies, you know, you usually have a protagonist and an antagonist, or you have a reluctant hero, or a very, very grey hero, a grey area hero who does some shitty things as well. And a villain who might do some good things. And, you know, it's never as cut and dried as all that. But their conflict, the fact that they are directly on paths that oppose each other and they get in each other's way, that's a great form of external conflict. But what I really like is when you have a protagonist and an antagonist, and obviously they're getting each other's way externally, and yet they both really get each other, as in probably better in some ways than anybody else does. And every so often they'll just come out with this little truism that completely spins the head of the other one. And there are times when they almost trade sides, or they're forced to work together. And I love it when you get the external conflict and the internal conflict where it's a case of, well, there but for the grace of God go I, because if it wasn't for this sort of setup, I might have gone in that direction. I could still go in that direction, or even I'm only two sneezes away from a killing spree too. I just need one really bad day. So I love it when they tread into that area of moral ambiguity through using the internal conflict and muddling those things up.
Yeah, absolutely. I really, really like that as well. I think it's also worth mentioning that the conflict between inter-characterical conflict between friends and stuff like that and secondary characters.
Yeah.
Which can create nice subplots. For example, nice, easy, famous one, Harry book 4.
Yeah.
There is a chunk of the fourth book when Harry and Ron are fighting.
Yeah.
And it's not part of the big main plot, but it does create quite a large amount of conflict. Similarly, the conflict between Harry and Snape and the conflict between Harry and Draco, these all make up something much larger. These are all based on kind of character. They're not really part of big main plot, but they're still important, but in a different way.
Yeah, I completely agree. I'm really hoping that he won't mind me mentioning this. I won't say names or anything, but hey, if you're listening, I'm taking this as a good example, okay? I did some beta reading recently, and it was a great book, and it was a sort of dystopian sci-fi fantasy pirate thing with sea monsters, and it was really cool. But one of the things that I my feedback brought up was the fact that the acting captain and his crew all got on really, really well all the time. As in there was no conflict between them at all. And this guy came back and said, you know what, you've hit the nail on the head there. And he said that they're thinking back to the first Star Wars film, yeah, Luke and Han are on the same side, and so's Princess Leia. They're all on the same side. They're all bickering from the minute they get together. Literally straight out of the cell, you're straight in with, aren't you a little short to be a stormtrooper? And it just sort of goes on from there. So, yeah, that would not have been an exciting film, probably, without those little pushes and pulls and strains between relationships. And it's something that gives you scope for exploration in the following films. So, yeah, you don't necessarily want a couple of friends who are at each other's throats all the time, but they shouldn't be agreeing all the time either. There's something not quite right if they are.
Yeah. Again, and there can be different dynamics. And you can definitely have characters who are just as thick as thieves and do get on.
Yeah.
But then you also need to add characters who don't get on, who cause that conflict. And I think a really good way of just remembering to look at it is that your main character, every person they meet should bring out something slightly different in them.
Yeah.
There needs to be something that they each need to occupy their own kind of area. So you might have the best friend character, and the conflict with the best friend character might be feelings of inadequacy, for instance, which you get in things like with Ron Weasley, this sense of inadequacy. And then you might have the boffin friend character, the friend who's very, very clever, Hermione Granger, great example, who causes conflict by being a bit of a know-it-all and maybe being a bit snobbish sometimes, or maybe a little bit not quite as fun in some ways, etc., etc., etc.
Basically, it's like we've said in a previous episode, it's really easy to be a saint if you live in a hermitage and never ever have any contact with anybody. But then you never develop, you never grow, you never do anything really good either. So it's that idea of, you know, merely having other characters represent potential conflicts as well. And, you know, even if you've got two friends who are thick as thieves, I mean, if we look at Jean and Locke from The Lies of Locke and Laura.
I'm so glad you mentioned them, because I was trying desperately not to.
That, you know, they're like a pair of crossed fingers all the way through, but when they fall out, when they really fall out, it is catastrophic. It's really bad. And that's the thing with friends who are really, really close, who pretty much agree all the time and they get on and they've always got each other's backs. At some point, they will disagree on something because they just will. That's the way the world is. And the corresponding argument or fallout or conflict is devastating because they so rarely argue.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. And I just think, to be honest, that if you put any two people together and they get on very well, if they're together too long, constantly, all the time,
yeah,
you know, our emotions also don't live in safe bubbles. We don't just continue to happily potter on, you know, different things will affect us and we will become bitter and angry and biting even to the people that we like. So conflict is inevitable. Even if it's not anger, it can be jealousy, it can be sadness, it can be confusion, misunderstanding, or even just not being on the same page.
Yeah, definitely. Final type of conflict I want to mention, and this is one that I have mixed feelings about, as in I can see why it's used, but I'm not a massive fan, probably because reading for me is kind of an escape a lot of the time. And that's where the writer deliberately sets it up so the character is in conflict with the reader. You tend to see this more in literary fiction, and generally the writer is asking you to think. I think it's quite a difficult trick to pull off because inherently the characters are nearly always really unlikable. But if you can write a compelling character that forces your reader to think, then that's quite interesting. The example that I would say did actually work for me on some level is Irvin Welsh's Trainspotting, where you've got Renton, who is a thoroughly unlikable character. He's untrustworthy and dishonest, because generally if you've hit that level of being addicted to heroin, you will be you'll be untrustworthy and dishonest, because you'll literally do anything for your next hit. I mean, he's not talking about functional heroin addicts. He's talking about people who were happy to live in complete squalor just for the next hit. And he does some really shitty things. And his friends are diabolical. They're awful. They're all awful people. And it's kind of asking you to think, I feel, just... For me, that film made me ask a lot of questions about people self-medicating and why they do it, and also whether it would be that bad if they were still, you know, is it a knee-jerk thing to say that heroin is bad? And I'm not suggesting anyone try heroin, by the way, but is it a knee-jerk thing to say it's bad when actually 50 years ago it was legal and we had functional heroin addicts who could get their supply whenever they needed it and it was clean? And they held down jobs, and they were contributing member society. So it's kind of like, is the system a bit fucked? So it did make me think a lot. I can't say I liked the book, and I can't say I liked the characters, but I did find it very compelling.
Yeah, I think another example of that is Ian McEwan.
Yeah. You're going to say Atonement, aren't you?
Well, no, I haven't actually read Atonement. But Ian McEwan, I've read Saturday, and then there's On Chesil Beach as well.
See, I read Atonement, and I couldn't forgive him for the double ending, so I didn't read any more of his books.
I don't actually get on with his writing, and it's simply because he does write these very unagreeable characters, let's put it that way. And for me, something that I need is I need to be able to like the characters, at least on one level, and I don't really like any of his main characters, because you're not supposed to, because they're kind of all meant to be detestable.
Yeah, see, I don't have to like them, but I do have to want to follow their journey. The other example I would cite, and I'm trying to remember, I never thought I would like a Louise O'Neill book, having read, and Amelia would agree with me on this, we discussed it at your party last year, Madeline, in scathing tones. We discussed Only Ever Yours, which is the most depressing and terrible dystopian book ever. But then I read a book called Almost Love earlier in the year, which again was written by Louise O'Neill. It has the most unlikable female protagonist ever. You know, she's a real bitch. Nasty stuff happens to her, but she's a real, real bitch. And yet it was like crack. It was like literary crack. I could not put this book down. And it made me think a lot about things like internalized misogyny. And, you know, that we say we've got equality between all the sexes. And yet the fact that it's not really like that at all. It's just gone underground. It's got better at hiding. And we can see this in the way that people act towards each other. So again, it was another one that really provoked a lot of thought.
Yeah. And I don't know if that's the one or if it's another one, but there is a YA book, and this may be the one exactly you're talking about, where there is a very, very unpleasant female main character who it's revealed, or during the course of the book, she gets sexually assaulted.
No, it wasn't that one.
This was just something that was brought up in one of my classes. I've not actually read the book itself, and I don't actually remember what it's called. But she's an incredibly unlikable character. And it is it's a YA book. And in the end, she is kind of assaulted. And the whole point of the book is to make you think about the fact that just because someone is unlikable, because someone is a bad person, does that mean they deserve deserve what happens to them, or what happened to them?
Yeah.
Did she deserve to get raped? And it was about basically sympathy. And suddenly, oh, it's harder to sympathize with her because she's not a nice person, when actually it should be, no, that was something that absolutely shouldn't have happened. And there should be, you know, despite the kind of person that she is.
You're not talking about 13 Reasons Why, are you, by Jay Asher?
No, I don't think it is 13 Reasons Why.
But that's a very similar premise. I've got a problem with Jay Asher, so I won't go into it. But ultimately, the entire thing is about rape culture.
Yeah.
Right, well, let's finish up off by looking at some of our favourite conflict tropes.
This is my favourite bit when we talk about our favourite tropes.
Yeah. Okay. I really like, as part of the romantic subplot in fantasy or whatever, I really enjoy a good enemies to lovers conflict resolution.
I would never have noticed.
Yeah, I suppose I have employed that recently, haven't I? They're not really enemies, mm-hmm. More a case of sort of like, I don't like you, I'm determined not to like you.
Yeah, I'm particularly fond of the I'm not supposed to fall in love with you conflict, the we're not even supposed to be friends conflict of two people on two different sides who are natural enemies who team up. And yeah. Kind of have to overcome a lot of their internal prejudices and sort of figure out, kind of meet in this middle ground.
I mean, I can go either way on that. I've seen that done really well in some fantasy, like Mary E. Pearson's The Remnant Chronicles and things like that. But
and Good Omens.
Yeah, Good Omens. I suppose that's true, actually. But if you take that literally as the whole sort of Romeo and Juliet thing, I'm kind of like, it doesn't interest me.
Yeah, no, I'm less fond of it like that. I'm more fond of it like in the case of, well, you're this kind of person and I'm this kind of person and we're both natural enemies and we're not really supposed to like each other and yet we're weirdly endeared to one another.
I mean, I love it if they both try and kill each other multiple times and just at the last minute it's kind of like, oh, I can't really do it, but I'm totally going to kill you next time. It's like, oh, well, you didn't kill me last time, so I guess I can't kill you this time, but next time, that's it.
I mean, it's what I do with Faye and Rufus. They're literally supposed to be mortal enemies.
Yeah.
And Faye wants to kill him and only just doesn't because Yonatan begs her not to. And then she can't help the fact she's like, oh, I'm supposed to hate you. Oh, I'm supposed to hate you. Oh, I'm supposed to hate you. And then she gradually just starts to like him instead. To the point that you get to the second book and she brings him, a mortal enemy of her people, to her home. And everyone else hates him. And she's like, I don't see what the fuss is about. You all need to calm down.
Yeah, I feel like I'm going to be naming tropes that I've just used recently, but I also really like the whole sort of the character who just wants the world to leave them alone, and then there's always one person who sort of slips in, all sort of small and innocent and sweet, and just fuck off and leave me alone, and manages to get under their guard and starts changing them that way.
That one, and I love this character you're talking about. I like the conflict of the job that will not go away.
Yes.
Which is particular for the reluctant hero of I don't have to do it. I'm just going to ignore it. But no matter how where they turn and where they go, they can't. They have to eventually face it, and they have to do it. I really, really like that one.
Classic Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Exactly. Even when they're trying not to do it, they end up doing it.
Definitely. Let's think of some others. I mean, really well done conflict is quite difficult to pick apart and just say this is a trope. So you can think of, oh, I really enjoyed the conflict between these two characters. And it's only when you start examining it that you think, well, actually, that's kind of that trope, but they've repackaged it in a way that it doesn't look like that trope, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I really, really like the conflict of two people who are really, really good friends and they love each other so intensely, yet they both do a very dangerous job. And so they're constantly fighting because the other one's constantly getting hurt. And it's like, you shouldn't be doing this, but they're literally doing it together. I think a great example of that is Jean and Locke, who are 100% married to the job that they have and to what they do. And who are almost always fighting about the fact that usually Locke has been hurt in the process.
Yeah. To be honest, I quite like... It's very bittersweet, and when I've read good examples of it, it's been, like, utterly destroying. But one where the conflict goes the other way, so they kind of get on really well, and they're really comfortable, perhaps for years, and maybe you even have, like, almost a family feel. And then they change, and they become different people, to the point where they end up on different sides of the line. So,
oh, that hurts. Yeah,
it really does. I'm thinking of Bloodhound by Tamora Pierce, which is part of the Becca Cooper series, and Becca and Tunstall, who is her superior officer, he's almost like a father to her. He even says, I think of you as a daughter, Becca. But he gets offered a lot of money to portray the crown, and it's something that Becca would never do. And they, you know, when she finally works out that the traitor must be either her best friend or the man she looks up to as a father, because she never had a father, or her new lover, she knows it must be one of these three people, and it's equally terrible whoever it is. And when it turns out to be Tunstall, it's such a punch in the gut, and they literally end up having a sword fight, which only one of them is going to walk away from. It's terrible, but it's so well done. It just keeps coming back to me.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, there's so many we could just go on. I love me some conflict. I really do love me some good old conflict.
Yeah, well done, conflict. I mean, I'm trying to think of an internal conflict example that I like, but I'm having difficulty, and it's not because I don't like internal conflicts. It's just they seem to separate themselves out a little bit less well.
I mean, one internal conflict that I quite like seeing is the conflict of inadequacy, or feeling like, yeah, you're not good enough, or that you're not capable enough, usually caused by some form of trauma. So there's lots of examples of this. In Fruits Basket, which was the anime that I mentioned a few episodes back, you have the character of Cure. And Cure has this entire thing where he's very brazen, and he's very competitive, and with another character called Yuki. And it all stems from this desperate fight to be recognized as equal. But not just as equal, but as a human being in general. It's really messed up. There's some messed up stuff in that manga. I really love it. and I really, really do. I like that, in that he's constantly competing. But the person he's competing with, it's not actually a human being. Similarly, and again, I don't want to give too many spoilers, but that's something that in your book, Jules, Revolt, that's something that Gregory is going through, because he's haunted by the memory of his dead brother, who he's constantly competing against, despite the fact his brother was a bit of a dick, let's not lie, and wasn't perfect. In fact, he was far from perfect. He was just a bad person. But Gregory still has to compete against him, even though everyone who kind of pitted them together at this point is dead.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like, get over your boyhood conflict. And it's a case of, well, no, he hasn't. He's gone abroad and fought for 10 years, and he's still carrying it around with him.
Yeah.
I suppose that's kind of an extension of the internal conflict, which I've kind of touched on in I Belong to the Earth, whereby you've got three sisters, and again, a similar sort of thing with Em and Grace, and the idea that when Em's perspective shifts and she starts to see things from Grace's perspective, and vice versa, they finally managed to get over this massive hurdle between them.
Yeah. Which was a massive hurdle.
Yeah.
I never thought I'd like Grace. I always hated her.
And yet, you hated her in the first book and then you were fine.
I really hated her in the first book, though. But yeah, I love trauma-induced, past trauma-induced internal conflict. It's a thing that I do all the time in my writing, but it's usually present in most of my favourite characters. They usually have induced internal conflict, which marks their character.
So it sort of brings us to the end of the episode, but basically conflict is good. If you want to tell a good story, you need conflict.
Yeah. And remember, conflict doesn't have to mean a big physical fight of some description. Conflict can be something as simple as losing something. It just results to there being a problem. Hell, if you're writing the right kind of story and someone has spilt milk, technically that acts as conflict, okay?
Well, yeah.
But it all depends what you're writing.
That's made me think of that terrible film that I doubt you'll have seen called Falling Down that's got Michael Douglas in it, and he's trying to get home for his son's birthday, and the traffic is terrible, but the last straw, the very last straw, is being given the wrong order in a burger joint, and then he just goes completely postal and starts shooting everyone.
There you go.
So, you know, conflict can send your characters in some really interesting directions. Don't have everybody being happy and nice and holding hands all the time. That's not how it works.
Yeah. And on that note, I think it's time for us to finish up. But before we do, we have time for our dissecting recommendation of the week. And Jules, I believe you've got one for us.
I have. This is really uncharacteristic for me because I've mentioned before how difficult I find to read graphic novels. But I picked up the first volume of Fence by C.S. Passett, who wrote the infamous The Captive Prince series. Now, this graphic novel is not sexy time fun, so don't think that, no matter what her other books are like. But it does feature a very, very slow burn male-male enemies to lovers thing, which is done really, really well. And it's basically about fencing, okay? It's about forming a fencing team, and it goes into a fair amount of detail. And I got through this first issue, and I was like, I need to read the next one. So I've loved the fact that I've been downloading them to my iPad, so I'm not adding to like more paper volumes to the shelf, which is great. But I can just read the next one. Anyway, 12 volumes later, I had spent the entire morning reading graphic novels, which is unheard of for me. And it is just really good. Don't expect lots of really ultra romance or anything like that. That's not what it's about. But this is almost entirely internal conflict, which is ironic when compared with the external conflict of a fierce fencing competition where they're training towards the Olympics at an exclusive all-boys school.
Can I just ask, what is... Oh, fencing! Right. Sorry.
Yeah,
with swords?
With swords, yeah.
Got it! Because the whole time you were explaining that, I was imagining, like, two farmers building fences.
Do you know of any sort of Olympic fence building events that I do?
Just well, that's wondering. What you, when you said Olympic, and I was like, an event, and I was like, oh, I must have got that wrong.
You complete wazzock. In fairness, I think the author might have titled it differently, but it makes perfect sense for the series. Anyway, I highly recommend it. It's really good, and the artwork is gorgeous, and the story is very, very compulsive. I mean, this is contemporary YA, which is already a strike against it for me, usually. And it's a graphic novel, which, again, is another kind of strike against it for me. And it's about something that I mean, I don't that's not the sort of sword play I have ever done or intend to do, really. Which again wouldn't normally interest me, but I was just completely hooked. It's so good.
Ooh, you've got me interested. And on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening, and guys, next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.